and fully understands, so awakened and understanding, he announces, points out, declares, establishes, expounds, explains, classifies, and clarifies it. What is that? All that is conditioned is impermanent. That's 19b. 19b. Lower part, beginning with the nature of Dhamma, and second paragraph by it. Third paragraph, on the page 20, and next 20, third paragraph, second from the top of page 20. That is, all conditioned things, all that is conditioned is unsatisfactory. The last paragraph, all dhammas are without self. Okay. Let us begin with that. Buddha was talking about the elements of Dhamma. There are all kinds of elements. Dhatu. We even pay respect to Dhatu. Dhatu Puja. Buddha's Dhatu. Arahant's Dhatu. And so forth, we use the word Dhatu. Dhatu simply means element. There is an element of Dhamma. That means all conditioned things have an element. Everything is based on this element. Dhatu means the root of all conditioned things. And Buddha's awakens to that, Buddha awakens to that, and Buddha understands that. That's what Buddhas do. What is the big deal? Don't we know things change? Things impermanent? What is there to understand? We grew. Now we are big boys and girls, with few grey hair here and there, with few wrinkles here and there. You know that. There's not very much to learn in that. And supremely enlightened Buddha awakens to that, understood that. And we all awaken to that, aren't we? And we all have understood that. Has this understanding, this awakening, brought an iota of wisdom to us, enlightenment? If so, we all are enlightened. We don't have to do anything. As we grew up, we grew with enlightenment. When we are fully matured and totally old, very old, then we are enlightened. It sounds like that, very simple. But we must pause and ask, are we really enlightened? What is this Buddha's special wisdom, understanding, awakening to this reality? And that is what we are trying to dig into in our practice of meditation. Buddha awakened to this. You know, he had this awakening when he saw the old man, at the age of 29, when he was 29, he saw an old man. He saw a sick man. He saw a dead man. That was the time he awakened to that. In a more deeper way, not like us. We all have that awakening, that understanding. What do we do about it? We just move on, carry on with our activities, completely ignoring it. We don't do anything about it. We get up every day, we go to work every day, we come home, we eat, we drink, we sleep, we get involved in everything we do every day. And this truth gently passed by us every moment. We never awaken to that. Every morning sun rises, every evening sun sets, every season trees change, plants change, life change, everything. We just move along with that. They change, we change, okay, go ahead. We don't gain one iota of insight from that. What kind of awakening we should have when we see this reality, this truth? Friends, we have to look at the larger picture. The larger picture is, larger picture begins from microcosm, not macrocosm. Microcosm is within us. We got to go into the very depth of our own experience every moment. This larger picture begins with the moment. If we see the moment, element, the base, root, foundation of this reality, then we can expand that understanding to everything in the universe. If you pause and ask yourself, don't ask to ask, don't use one word, because this reality we don't see when we open our eyes. We may see this reality superficially, very tiny little bit of it we can see when we open our eyes. To see this reality, close our eyes. Like a platypus. You know platypus? An animal that lives in Tasmania. Only animal that hunts eyes closed. Other animals hunt, eyes open. This animal is like he has a duck-like beak, duck-like webbed feet. It is like a beaver living in water. On his beak, there is a special device, that is his nose, two holes to breathe in and breathe out, and also he has on the nose electric prod. When he opens his eyes, this electronic device closes. When he opens his eyes, this electronic device opens. And it sends electric waves, electric current towards the prey. It's just like a radar, just like this Star Wars. It goes, this electric waves go looking for animals. And it reflects back onto him, and then he moves over towards that and catch the animal. All the animals that hunts with eyes closed. That is the time he sees reality, the truth. Similarly, when we close our eyes and focus our total mindful attention to every tiny little thing that happens to us, in us, not in the universe, not in the world. Don't close your eyes and think of politics, economics, business, social activities, and all kind of interplanetary communications. That's what normally people do. They try to do planetary business, planetary communication, going from one planet to another planet. This world is not big enough when you close your eyes. They keep moving in the planet, universe. Don't do that. Come home, come back. This is what the Buddha said, come and see. Come and see, what does it mean? Come and see. Ehi pasira. Come where? See what? Come and see the building, people, furniture, the movies, or grocery, clothes. What do we see? Come and see the library, open books. Come and read books? No. And come where? When we say come and see, where do we go? And see what? Come and see means come inside. Close to your mind, close to your heart, close to your body, close to your feeling. Come closer and closer and closer and see that feeling, see that body, see that dhamma. Where is dhamma? This elemental truth, where is that? It is everywhere. But when we see everywhere, we cannot see anything. It is, you know, sometimes somebody asked, certain things in a very learned person said, Buddha just said such and such. So somebody asked him, where did he say that? He said, everywhere. Everywhere means where? It is everywhere. Tell me one example. He cannot tell one example. He said, everywhere. When we say everywhere, you will get nowhere. Therefore, don't try to grab everything like trying to grab a whole heap of orange. You cannot grab even one. Therefore, we have to come and see, not the whole universe, come and see closer to ourselves, our own mind, our own body, to see the Dhamma. Where is Dhamma? What is Dhamma? Dukkha is Dhamma. Where is that? Dukkha is the first truth of the Four Noble Truths. Dukkha, suffering. Where is that? It is not in a building, in a house, in a book. Dukkha is in us. So come closer and see this dukkha. Where it comes from? From this impermanence. From this impermanence. Where is impermanence? In us. We change. We change. Friends, we change all the time. It is the truth. There's no secret in it. And we must be awakened to that reality, that truth. In a very deep level. Deep level means in a minutest level, in a cellular level, in subatomic levels. You know, when we see the impermanence in subatomic levels, we are no longer huge living human beings. We are just changing, moving motion all the time. Waves, not something static. We are always dynamic. Not one single object in us remains the same even for one consecutive, two consecutive moments. We are changing. Every cell in our body is changing. Every moment of our feeling is changing. Every perception is changing. Every thought is changing. Every moment of consciousness is changing. These are the five aggregates. We must see these changes within ourselves with our eyes closed. Only when we close our eyes, focus the mind on us, without assumption, presumption, preconceived notion, ideas, beliefs and so forth. Don't believe in anything. This is what the Buddha said. Don't believe in mere hearsay and so forth in Kalama Sutta. Don't believe in anything. Just watch. Watch the mind. Watch the body. Watch the feeling. Watch the perception. This is what we do in Vipassana meditation. Just keep watching, looking, looking. Just paying total mindful attention. What is the mindful attention? You know, when we pay attention to something, that thing becomes clear to us. Only when we pay attention. If we do not pay attention, nothing becomes clear to us. So what kind of attention we have to pay? We have to pay mindful attention. What is mindful attention? This is a big, heavily loaded term we use always. Mindful, mindful, mindful. What is that? What is mindfulness? Mindful attention is the attention without greed, hatred and delusion. Mindful attention is impartial attention. Mindful attention is clear, pure, simple attention. Mindful attention is attention to let the object reflect in our mind. Impermanence, let impermanence reflect in the mind. Don't make it impermanent. Don't make anything impermanent. Don't try to do that. We don't try to make anything impermanent. We don't want to do it. We cannot make anything impermanent. Because even the Buddha simply awakened to it, he did not make anything impermanent. Nobody can make anything impermanent. Nobody can make anything permanent. Intentionally we cannot make anything permanent. No, unintentional. Things are permanent, things are impermanent. They are permanently impermanent. That is the only permanent thing. Only permanent thing is impermanence. Permanently impermanent. This permanently impermanence has to be realized, understood by paying mindful attention. When we pay mindful attention, impermanence simply keeps passing and passing and passing through every moment. When we realize that, then there is, what is the big deal? Why do you want to realize that? One day, even little child can talk about impermanence. When I was in Washington, there was one of my professors had a little child. He was only 10 days old when I came to the United States, and this child he brought to the temple every day. And he read books in the library, put that little baby in a cot, he was reading. And this child grew up like my own child. Every day he saw me. And as he grew up, he came and hugged me, kissed me, sat on my lap, and grew every day like little my own child. So one day when he was about, whenever I go somewhere and return, he comes and hugs me saying, "My sadhu, my sadhu, my sadhu." So one day when he was about 12 years old, I said, "Michael, you are unhuggable now, big boy, what happened? He said, Bhante, let us face reality. We all change. We all change. I am changed. So even little child can talk about it. But what kind of insight that child gets from knowing things are eternal? We all know it is the common sense things. And Buddha said he was awakened to it. He understood it. Having understood, he did not keep quiet. Ācikkati deseti panyapeti pattapeti vivarati vivacati uttani karoti. That means in English, he announces, points out, declares, establishes, expounds, explains, clarifies, and classifies and clarifies. So many things he has done with this impermanence. How many things we do with impermanence? We may understand just like a little dream, you know, occasionally. Yeah, changed. My boy, he's a big boy now. My girl is a big girl now. That's all we know. Yesterday he was crawling, today he may be walking. We know that. Yesterday he was playing with a toy, today he is playing with football. Yesterday he was going with girls, today he is clinging to money. We know this. They're changing. But what do we learn from this change? This impermanence. Establish Dhamma. The element of Dhamma. Truth. What do we learn? What insight we gain? Not very much. You know, insight we should gain is this is the thing we cling to. This impermanent thing we cling to. This little baby that was born yesterday, today is crawling, tomorrow is playing, next day is going after girl or boy, and then get a job, have money, grow up, have his own home, independent, man or woman. That's all we know. But along with that, we have a clinging. Clinging to little baby. People say, it is better to be babies because they don't have craving, desire. That is not true. You know, desire or craving, clinging, begins from the moment of conception. When the egg is released, it waits for one or two days for the sperm to come and join. When the sperm come with all kind of fight, with all kind of anti-things coming in there to protect them, prevent it from getting in, as soon as he comes and joins the egg, egg immediately covers it. Build a wall around it, so that no other sperm can enter it. Desire. Greed. Clinging. Holding. Attachment. And then move on, and then after 6 days it burrows into the uterus wall. Clinging. Holding on to it. Craving. Always from that moment until we die, craving in for various things. And born with a big cry. Who is born with a big smile? Nobody. Why do we cry? One thing, we all cry when we are born, unless we were born in water. When we, if we were born in water, we may not cry, because it is not too much different from mother's liquid inside the womb and water. Therefore, babies slowly, smoothly swim in the water. That time they don't breathe, because mother supplies everything. As soon as the baby comes out, and when this umbilical cord is cut, and then start crying. Not because of the pain of the cutting of umbilical cord, but because that environment has changed. When the environment changed, the baby was clinging, attached to the environment, and when it changes, baby cries because of attachment. And why the baby cries now? Cries for so many things. Cries for milk, cries for sugar, cries for warmth, cries for comfort, cries for mother's hug, cries for all these things. And then one may not cry out loud, but that cry goes inside, smoldering inside. And for the next 30, 50, 60, 100 years, maybe the baby keeps crying. Crying for what? Crying for so many tons of sugar, so many tons of starch, so much medicine, so much clothes, so much books, so much roads, so much vehicles, so many jobs, so much money, so many people, so many comforts. Keep crying. We all cry. We never stop this cry. Why? Because of desire. Now, underneath all these things, what follows us, what undermines all this is impermanence. Everything, impermanence betrays us, undermines everything. And therefore, Buddha awakened to this reality. Having awakened to this reality, what happened when he awakened to the reality? Because of this craving for impermanent things, we suffer. Because of craving for impermanent things, because of desire for impermanent things, we suffer. Impermanent things should be realized, experienced, whatever, whenever we can use them, we use them. And while using them, we have to keep in mind that this is impermanent, and not only think that they are impermanent, but we must realize while experiencing, while enjoying impermanent things, we must realize, we must see this reality. While eating, for instance, we see impermanence. We enjoy a very delicious meal. You know, this delicious meal is delicious until it leaves the throat into the stomach. Then there is no delicious. The meal that we eat is delicious only when it is in the mouth, when it touches our taste buds. After that, it is not delicious. What we have is just a memory of delicious food. And keep this memory as a desire for next delicious meal. So, when we eat mindfully. How we eat mindfully? Don't say in words, but mindfully, without greed, hatred and delusion, taste the deliciousness and see how the deliciousness is disappearing. Impermanence. And then don't become greedy for that. Just become aware of it. And it is not possible for an average person who is not mindful. So when we are greedy for something impermanent, we end up in suffering. Why? we cannot get that thing all the time in the same way. Either that thing is changed, we are changed, situation changed, we don't have enough money, we don't have that kind of cook, that kind of restaurant, we may be sick, this and that, all kind of other factors involve our life. Many factors. Therefore, not one single thing remains to be the same. Not one single thing can exist by itself. To make this delicious, there has to be many other things involved, and all other things are impermanent. So, Buddha realized, Buddha awakened to this reality. Things are without our control, not under our control. They are all beyond our control. They are changing. And we are living in this impermanent world and expect the world to be permanent. We are experiencing impermanent, living in impermanent world, expecting something to be permanent. That is where we have suffering. That is why we said, we realize that all conditioned things, when we look at this anything, any particular thing, that thing is conditioned by many other factors. They all are impermanent. And because of, somebody said, the very popular teacher said, I don't think every impermanent thing is unsatisfactory. He said, for instance, this table in front of me is impermanent. Who cares? I don't feel that. The table doesn't suffer. I don't suffer. It is impermanent. You know, this is where one needs insight to understand the relationship with that table and us. What is our relationship to the table? How the impermanence of the table can make me suffer? Because these appear to be two separate entities. It is not part of my body. But why do I have this table in front of me? Why? Because I can put my cloth on it. I can put a paper on it and write. I can put a book on it and read. I can put my table lamp on it and have light. I can use the table for something or other. If the table all of a sudden breaks, collapses, where can I put my paper? Where can I put my book, light, lamps and so forth? That creates inconvenience to me. And while I was using, I enjoy the comfort. When it disappears, I lose the comfort. Therefore, while I have it, I have certain amount of attachment to the table. Although it is inanimate object, I think this is my table. This is mine. So long as I have that connection, this is mine, this is useful to me, I enjoy its being used, its utility, utilitarian value, I enjoy it. And so long as I have this attachment, clinging, craving, desire for the table, when it breaks, changes, disappears, I feel uncomfortable. This is unsatisfactory. This is what the Buddha said. So long as we have a greed, attachment, clinging to anything in the world, we have craving. Friends, when we talk about this, people get sometimes very upset. How can we live without clinging, craving, attachment? Surely you cannot live. And that is why the Buddha said in the next one, on page 41, These two are very close related, related passages. Page 41 he said there, impermanent is all that is conditioned. When one sees this with wisdom, one turns away from suffering. This is the path to purity. You got to read this very carefully. Don't just read superficially. Read between lines and think very carefully. Impermanence is all that is conditioned when one sees this with wisdom. We have to see impermanence with wisdom. You see, not just with common sense. Yes, it was like the trees were green yesterday, today they were red, their color changed. Yeah, impermanence, what's it? Not that kind of thing. But see this with wisdom. When one sees this with wisdom, one turns away from suffering. Who clings to suffering? When you say one would turn away from suffering, it implies that somebody is clinging to suffering. Who clings to suffering? Who enjoys suffering? Does anybody enjoy suffering? Nobody enjoys suffering. Then why should we turn away from it? We already turn away from suffering. So what is the meaning of this? And that turning away from suffering is the path of purity. Is the path to purity. Now, in another place Buddha said, yo sukhaṁ abhinandati so dukhaṁ abhinandati. One who enjoys pleasure enjoys suffering. What does it mean? One who enjoys pleasure enjoys suffering. Yo sukhaṁ abhinandati, abhinandana means enjoying. If somebody enjoys pleasure, he enjoys pain. Isn't it true? You may say it is not true. I just enjoy pleasure, I never enjoy pain. But friends, unfortunately, these two come in one package. When you buy one, other comes free. You got to accept both. So, one day we went to a shop to buy a pair of shoes to one of our cooks in the Bhavana Sati. That day, when we went to the shop with a friend of mine, he wanted to buy a pair of shoes for him. That day, the shopster came out or something. They said, if you buy one shoe, one pair now, we can give you another free. And this young man was so simple, he said, he bought one and then we asked, which one you want to get free? He said, I don't need any pair. Even if they give free, I don't need any. The shopkeeper said, my man, we don't charge anything, you take it free. Choose whatever you like. He said, even if you give free, I don't need any. I need only one pair. And when they gave it free, I took that. Free pair. So, with the suffering you cannot do that. when you ask to get pleasure and then pain comes with that, You cannot say, okay, I take only pleasure. Let somebody else have the pain. You cannot say that. It comes together as one pair. That is the unfortunate thing. It is just like, I tell you, very practical, common example. Nobody should get offended. These are just reality. I am not pointing out to any one particular person. A mother, for instance, having 5 children. What a joy it is. What a pleasure it is. What a happiness to have so many children. 5 children? 2 girls, 3 boys. Big girl is taking care of her younger brother and sister. So what a relief for the mother. But the mother, every day, spent 24 hours, for instance, perhaps, cooking for them, washing their clothes, sending them to school, making their clothes, shopping for them, taking care of their medicines, doing their homework, cleaning the house, making their bed, and doing everything for them, because mother loves to have these 5 children. Can she have a vacation? Can she go to restroom without having trouble with any of one of these little toddlers? Can she sleep well without having one is sick? One is crying. One is doing this and that. Every single day, every single moment, one thing or another mother has to do for these children. And she enjoys doing all this. But at the same time, see the amount of pain that she goes through. But she doesn't mind pain because she loves children. Soon she gets sick. Still she loves these 5 children. Children cannot do very much for the mother. And still she suffers from a sickness. At the same time, at the back of her mind, there is a pleasure, joy, having these 5 children. Can she separate these two? This joy that she has for having children and the pain that she has, she cannot separate them. They come all together in one package. She has to go through. Similarly, this is one example. You can think of trillions of examples. So, the pleasure always comes with pain. Now, when one understands impermanence, one learns to turn away from the pain. Why the pain? Because of clinging, craving, attachment. If mother can have pleasure without attachment to any of these children, who comes from inside wisdom, knowing the truth, element of Dhamma. This element of Dhamma is not created by the Buddha. Buddha simply awakened to it. Buddha simply understood it. It is there. Impermanence is not created by somebody. The universe is always impermanent. Universe is not this human world. Universe is much inconceivably unlimited, unlimited thing. Everything in it is impermanent. Today here this world is here, when it disintegrates, disappears, something else appears. That is the nature of the universe. And that is there all the time, whether Buddhas come into existence or not. What the Buddhas do is they come into existence and they realize this. And they try with wisdom, not to get attached to this impermanent world, impermanent body, impermanent perception, impermanent thoughts and impermanent feeling. No attachment. When we have feeling, whether it is, if it is pleasant feeling, we experience it and we know it, we know it is pleasant. When unpleasant feeling arises, we experience it, we know it, we know it is impermanent. We don't try to reject unpleasant feeling, nor do we try to cling to the pleasant feeling. And so forth and so on, related to this body and mind. So, then the last thing in both sections has something different. He said, all dhammas are without self. When one sees this with wisdom, one turns away from suffering. And that is the path to purity. I want to explain this, but I don't have time to do that now. Sometimes people say, when all dhammas are without self, why did the Buddha change the wording here? First two stanzas say, all conditioned things are impermanent, unsatisfactory. And when he came to the last stanza, he said, all dhammas are without self. Some people say, Buddha changed this word in order to include Nibbana as well. Nibbana is one of the ninefold dhammas. Navalokuttara dhamma, out of Navalokuttara dhamma, one is Nibbana, Supramandhen dhammas. In order to include that, Buddha used the word dhamma. Friends, that is also total misconception, misunderstanding, misinterpretation. Because, of course, logic is this. They think, since all conditioned things are impermanent, all conditioned things are unsatisfactory, all conditioned things are without self. If we say that, then the opposite of that should be permanent, satisfactory and with self. For instance, if conditioned things are impermanent, unsatisfactory and without self, unconditioned things should be with self, with permanence, with satisfaction and with self. What is unconditioned? Only unconditioned is Nibbana. Therefore, they think, to avoid misunderstanding that Nibbana has self, they think the Buddha included Nibbana also here. That is a completely wrong interpretation. Why? When one turns away from suffering, when where the suffering exists, does it exist in Nibbana? No. In every stanza he says, when one sees this wisdom, one turns away from suffering. That means one turns away even from Nibbana. Because Nibbana also has to have suffering. And then, that is the way to purity. Now, if one turns away from Nibbana, where should one go? There's nothing, no place to go. Moreover, here it's Nibbana is not included because all Buddha was talking about the things in this universe, in the conditioned world, then why did he change the word all dhammas are impermanent, without self? We have to go to the text, especially to commentary. The commentary says, in Pali words, sabbe dhamma anattadi. Sabbe dhamma means all dhammas. Commentary says, dhammas here, dhamma ati panchupada nakhanda eva gahita. Dhammati panchupada nakhanda eva gahita. Commentary says, the dhamma here means the five aggregates themselves. Five aggregates themselves. Sankhara is all mental activities. Dhamma means everything else. So in order to, Buddha was talking about the five aggregates. It is the knowledge of five aggregates. It is the knowledge of impermanence of the five aggregates, knowledge of unsatisfactoriness of five aggregates, knowledge of selflessness of five aggregates that leads to purity. Then in Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, Anatta Lakkhana Sutta and so forth, Buddha said, in short, all the five aggregates are suffering. Friends, it is because of our attachment to the five aggregates we are suffering. It is when we are liberated from this attachment to the five aggregates, we become free from suffering. All our attachment is to the five aggregates. This is even a little more complicated. Sometimes people might wonder, when the weather change, when the there's a massacre somewhere. Say in the United States itself, somebody somewhere say some children go to school with guns and kill few children and teachers. That aches our heart, isn't it? That aches our heart. We feel so miserable, so unhappy. It is so painful to us to think that little children taking guns and shooting other children and teachers in schools. We have pain. We suffer. We are unhappy. It is unsatisfactory. Then people ask, what that got to do with the five aggregates? Buddha said, clinging to five aggregates is suffering. All the five aggregates are suffering. What that shooting in school got to do with our five aggregates? Somebody can say, ask. Friends, it has everything to do with the five aggregates. When we hear some children were killed there, we feel that feeling is suffering. We are attached to the pleasantness. We want the whole world to be peaceful and happy. Children to be peaceful, teachers to be peaceful, parents to be peaceful, country to be peaceful, everything to be peaceful. We like that. And yet, we are attached to that peace. That's our feeling. Since we are attached to that peace, when it is shattered, when the peace is gone into pieces, we have pain. That is because of our attachment to our feeling that we pain, that we suffer. Therefore, no matter what happens in the world, if we suffer, it is because of our attachment to that particular feeling, that particular perception, that particular thought, that particular consciousness, we suffer. We are attached to that, we are attached to the worldly situation. When the stock market crashed, we may not have any stock in the market. And yet we have the pain. Why? Because when stock market doesn't crash, economy is good. People have money. Things will be cheap. And that affects us. We like that. That we are attached to that liking. That attachment is, that liking is our feeling. So we are attached to that liking. Therefore, when it happens over there, we suffer. Therefore, no matter what happens in the world, if we suffer, it is because of our attachment to the five aggregates. What are the five aggregates? Four. We feel, how can I support this body? Food is expensive. Clothes is expensive. There's not enough money. How can I support this body? Because of my attachment to the body, when those things happen, I suffer. So, when we look at the Buddha, the teachings of the Buddha, reality, the truth of the Buddha, we really become delightful. When we learn insight meditation and see the truth in a very minutest way and expand into the universe, since we are part of it, every tiny little thing is interrelated, and therefore with wisdom, insight, understanding, we can see our place in the universe and how we suffer when something happens at the other end of the universe. Because they all are, all affect our lives. Therefore, friends, this insight meditation starts completely, totally, perfectly only from us to look at us, to look at the way how things affect our life, how we relate to the world, how we suffer because of our attachment to not only the five aggregates, but everything affects the five aggregates. We are attached to all of them. Therefore, I think this may be enough. I don't want to go on and on. I will give a few remarks on at the conclusion, summarizing all these things. And for now, I think I should stop this talk. And thank you very much for your patience. Is organized in connection with the Vesak celebration. To honor the Buddha, to commemorate his 2546th anniversary, to celebrate his birthday, his death anniversary, and the anniversary of his passing away, all took place on one full moon day in the month of May. Not exactly in one full moon day. But he was so kind, so compassionate, that all he decided to do all this on a full moon day like this. Otherwise we have to have three celebrations. One birthday, one enlightenment day, one passing away day. So he, even his passing away, he decided to make it so easy for us. And we celebrate all this on one day. I think it is very rare that somebody can have all these major events of his life on one particular day, full moon day. In the month of May, when everything is blossoming, see all around us everything is lushy, green, flowers, birds, insects, all come to life. Everything springs. And he also attained enlightenment at the same time. So this is a time to be jubilant, happy, rejoice, peaceful. And we therefore have a reason to be happy, to celebrate, to enjoy. We have Buddhist countries, we celebrate this day in a very religious way, very solemn, at the same time very jubilant way. Everybody joins together, observe. In some countries they observe the 8 precepts. I know more about Sri Lankan tradition. In Sri Lanka we celebrate this day for about a week, making beautiful candles, beautiful gateways with all kind of decorations. Some are very unique. Nowhere else can you see decorations made of coconut leaves, coconut flowers, areca nut leaves, areca nut flowers, and this elephant plant, which has a big leaves. They use them to cut and make various type of decorations. And the people wearing white assemble, go to temples. Sometimes some temples have 6,000 people observe the 8 precepts. 5,000 people observe the 8 precepts in every temple. And they walk on foot, wearing white, go from house, temple to temple. And in every intersection, there will be stores, food stores, drink stores, food, drink, all served free of charge. People, when they walk, those who have organized all these food stalls, invite people to come and eat and drink, not liquor, not meat. In many traditions, when they do religious celebrations, these poor animals, millions of them are slaughtered to celebrate religious holidays, religious events. They kill many, many animals, birds and deer and cows and so forth. They kill millions of them. But in Buddhist tradition, even those people who are non-vegetarians, that day they all are vegetarians. They don't eat meat. And generously they share things with others. Not sharing cards, since card system came just very recently, sending Visa cards. Still it has not become so commercial. In some countries it may be catching up, thanks to Western civilization. They are now trying to become, imitate Western celebrations, but in more traditional places, they still, instead of exchanging cards, they exchange real generous gifts like food, drinks and so forth. So if even people travel, if they don't come to these food stalls, people, organizers get offended. They go and grab them. Please come and eat something, drink something. They say, no, I'm full. I have food inside. No one come and they give it. So they force them to come and eat, drink something. Sometimes very expensive things like, you know, coconut. That is expensive thing, but they drink for you free. Those who are not generous at the time, that time they are very generous. In the name of Buddha. Because we believe that Buddha was the one who sacrificed everything for us to attain enlightenment, to help us. So we want to help each other in the name of the Buddha. We don't want to kill in the name of the Buddha on that day. We don't want to steal that day in the name of the Buddha. We don't want to tell lies on the day in the name of the Buddha. We don't want to drink on that day in the name of the Buddha. How wonderful it is, isn't it? One day, that particular day, they give up all this and go to temples, spend 24 hours in the temple, listening to Dhamma talks, discussing Dhamma, reading Dhamma books, meditating, showing their friendliness, understanding, compassion. Other days they may not even talk to each other. That day they all are friends. Many people forget all their past, differences. That day they all become friends. And that's a wonderful thing to do, to show our gratitude to the Buddha. And this is exactly what he asked us to do. We may store our mind with knowledge of Dhamma. We read a lot of Dhamma books and memorize everything. And we use them generally to show how much we know, to debate, to argue, to press our points, impress others with our knowledge. And when it comes to practice, we don't practice. And here is the one who came to this world without shedding one drop of blood. He came to this world. Buddha never slaughtered anybody to attain enlightenment. He never shed a drop of blood. And all his life he taught non-violence, peace. You know, even after the Buddha, we have in Buddhist countries, there are various Buddhist schools. Northern school, Southern school, Tibetan Buddhism, Japanese Buddhism, Chinese Buddhism, Sri Lankan Buddhism, Thai Buddhism, Burma, so forth. Vietnam Buddhism, Korean Buddhism, and so forth. But we all have differences. We never had any religious war to conquer other sects. And we all learned to, we all agreed to disagree. You follow your sister, we follow our sister, we have differences. Still, we all follow the Buddha's footsteps. You know how disgraceful it is to the religious leader if his followers fight among themselves to conquer others in the name of this religious leader. Killing each other. Not really killing each other or killing others who don't believe his teaching. unfortunately, so far, Buddhists have never fought among Buddhist themselves to, of course, when we say that, how about killing in Sri Lanka now? Somebody can point out. Of course, that has nothing to do with the Buddha's teaching. It is not following, it is because of not following the Buddha's teaching that's happened. If they all learn to follow the Buddha's teaching, that would have never happened in Sri Lanka. Buddhists can kill, just like anybody else. Why can they kill? How can they kill? Because they have greed, they have hatred, they have confusion, ignorance. Whoever has greed, hatred and ignorance can kill. But fortunately, no Buddhist can quote the Buddha saying, you can kill on such and such an occasion. They can never justify their killing, quoting the Buddha. That is very fortunate thing. Because Buddha has never, ever mentioned anywhere that we can kill for one reason or another. Because of our greed, hatred and ignorance, we kill. Fortunately, we cannot blame the Buddha. We cannot blame the Dhamma, his teaching. So, in order to respect the Buddha, who came to this world, when he came to this world, after he came to this world, he said, bhikkhus, ekapuggalo bhikkhu loke upadmano upadyati, bahujana hitaya bahujana sukhaya, bahuno janaya hitaya sukhaya arthaya deva manushana. Bhikkhus, one individual comes to this world for the benefit of human beings, for the welfare of human beings, for the benefit and welfare of all living beings. No, he didn't say that. For the benefit of many, that is the word, that is the catchy point. One individual came to this world, comes to this world, for the benefit of many human, for the welfare of many human and divine beings. He did not say for all. Why? Why didn't he say that a Buddha comes to this world for the benefit of all? Not that he was unkind or racist or provincialist, nationalistic, not because of that, but because he was enlightened. Enlightened person always speaks the truth from the he's very practical and realistic. He said the Buddha is a teacher, or he's a guide, he's a trainer of the trainable, tamer of the tamable. Purusa Dhammasarathi. Purusa Dhammasarathi means, that word is not Dhammasarathi. You look up the book, it is not Dhammasarathi, it is Dhammasarathi. Not Mahaprana Dha, or accented Dha, but the Dhammasarathi. Dhammasarathi means the one who trains the trainable. You know, even the Buddha cannot train the untrainable. Even the Buddha cannot train the untamable. If he were able to tame the untamable, he would have made Devadatta a wonderful disciple. Even he could not tame Devadatta. Although he was living with the Buddha, wearing the robe, he was his disciple. He even had attained jhanas, supernatural powers, but still Buddha could not tame him to be a saint. If he were able to tame the untamable, Chundasukara, who lived just behind the Jetavana monastery, here Buddha was teaching Dhamma, for 25 years in Jetavana Monastery, where Buddha spent 25 vassas out of his 45 ministry. 25 years he spent in Jetavana Monastery. Behind that monastery was a man killing pigs. You know, killing pigs was so noisy, these pigs were tortured to kill. And they were squeaking very loudly. Buddha could not stop that. Could not tell him. This man never came to see the Buddha, listen to one word of the Buddha's Dhamma. Why? He could not tell. Similarly, of course, when that was the case, while he was alive, how much more difficult it is for us to teach those who do not want to listen to Dhamma, those who hate the Buddha and Buddhism. What can we do? Knowing this reality, Buddha said, he came to this world for the benefit of many. Many. So somebody went to the Buddha and asked them, "Sir, one time, his name was Fukusagi. Venerable Ananda was next to the Buddha. This man came and asked the Buddha, "Sir, how many people do you think can understand your Dhamma? Can the whole world understand your Dhamma? Or one half of can understand Dhamma? Or one quarter of the people in the world can understand Dhamma? How many of them can attain enlightenment? Whole world, one half, one quarter?" Buddha just kept quiet because this is a very trivial question. Then Venerable Ananda answered the question. "You know, if Buddha were somebody else with egotistic leader, when somebody came and asked him a question and his student answered the question, the leader would get offended. And he would think that, hey, how come you answered my question? He asked me the question. You are my student. If you answer my question, you are insulting me. I'm supposed to answer the question. Who are you? Get out." He would have said. Buddha just kept quiet. Venerable Ananda answered the question. Venerable Ananda said, "Sir, the Buddha is not interested. He asked how many people can attain enlightenment? One whole world, half world, one third, one quarter?" Then Venerable Ananda said, "Sir, Buddha is not interested in statistic. It is that Buddha is not a statistician. Buddha was not interested how many. Buddha was interested how, not how many. How is more important than how many. How to attain enlightenment, even if one person attains enlightenment, by following that method, then the system works. That is all Buddha is interested in. How to attain enlightenment, not how many." So, another person asked, "Suppose there are all type of people. Which of them you choose to teach?" Then Buddha asked him, sometimes Buddha answers people's question by asking question, counter-questioning. When this man asked this question, Buddha asked him, "Sir, are you a farmer?" He said, "I'm a farmer." "Okay, there are three fields. One is very fertile. When you plant a seed, it grows very well. Second is not fertile, but when you work a little harder, you can grow something there. Third is very tough, rugged, dry. You put seeds there, it takes years and you simply feel you are wasting your time. Which of these fields you choose to grow your seeds, sow your seeds? He said, "Sir, I choose the first one, which is fertile. That will pay back my effort, my energy, my capital." Buddha said, "Similarly, I choose those who can be tamed, to tame." And that is why he said, one individual comes to this world, it doesn't mean that he was not compassionate. It doesn't mean he was unkind to others. But as I said, Buddha is a practical person, enlightened person. Enlightened person always says things that can be practical. Buddha said in one place, "Because I never ask you to do anything that you cannot do." That's a wonderful statement. He said, "Because I never ask you to do something that you cannot do, I ask you to always ask you to do something that you can do." So, that is why he said, one individual comes to this world for the benefit of many, for the welfare of many, who would listen and learn, memorize, put it into practice. So, let us try to be individuals like that first rice field, fertile field. Don't try to be barren. So we want to show our gratitude to the Buddha for the things that he has done for us. You know, what he has done 2000, almost 600 years ago, is still practical. In the name of the Buddha, on this day, to show our gratitude towards the Buddha, we must do very our might just to show our gratitude. Buddha said, "Because he has addressed the bhikkhus," because they were the ones who always were with him. That doesn't mean that he ignored other people. What the message he gave to bhikkhus is good for all other persons. He said, "Bhikkhus, you do me a favor. Do me a favor. What is it? Please, jhaya bhikkhu, ma cha pamado, ma te kama gune bhamasu cittam, ma loha gulan gili pamato, ma kandi dukkha midanti daihyamano." Because don't cry saying it is suffering, suffering, suffering. Jhaya bhikkhu, meditate. Ma cha pamado, don't be negligent. Māte kāma gunasya bhamasya cittam. Don't let your mind go round the world in seeking sensual pleasures. Mā dukkhamidanti daihyamāno, mā khandi dukkhamidanti daihyamāno. Don't cry saying, this is suffering, this is suffering. Do me a favor, go and meditate. Go and meditate. You know, when we meditate, does Buddha get any benefit out of the matter? Any profit, any share? Just like investing in the stock market, if for him to get little share sitting somewhere for our, we are investing there, and he can get the little interest from our capital, from our gain? No. He was so compassionate. So compassionate. When we meditate, who benefits? We benefit. He is very much like a benevolent mother. Benevolent mother wants to, suppose a child is sick. What the benevolent mother does? She would bring the child and the medicine is there. That medicine, child does not want to take medicine. Child will kick and wheel and weep and cry and sob and do all sort of things not to take the medicine. What the mother does, she brings the child, put him on her lap and talk to the child, sing song, tell stories, give sweets, promise all kind of things. If you eat this, I give you candy. If you eat this, I take to a show. If you eat this, I get this toy for you. If you eat this, I give you a special TV show and bring a video game and buy a video game. All kind of promises mother does, and slowly give this medicine to the child. Why? Mother loves the child. Similarly, Buddha wanted us to get well. We are sick. We are sick. Sick of greed, sick of hatred, sick of delusion, sick of anger, sick of jealousy, fear. Buddha wanted us to get rid of these things. Free from these things. And therefore he said, jhaya, well, meditate. For our own benefit. And why we want to do that? We want to respect the Buddha. In order to respect the Buddha, we do something which benefits us. You see? Therefore, how can he be? How can we show respect to the Buddha when he is no longer here? He is passed away. He is not here. But still, we want to show our gratitude to the Buddha. And Buddha said, see the Dhamma. You can see me. Your Dhammapasa is so mangpasa. One who sees the Dhamma sees me. How can we see the Buddha? We see the Dhamma. When we practice Dhamma, when we see Dhamma, we can see the Buddha. The more we practice Dhamma, the more we put Dhamma into our practice, we can see what a wonderful, enlightened, compassionate being he was. Dhamma, he said, Tathagata pavetito dhamma vinayo vivato virochati no patichano. The dhamma taught by the Buddha shines when open, not when it is hidden.